Okay, there you go. That's me. So as Stephen mentioned at the beginning, I come from the information services, which is a central support team, division or group in the university. And my particular role in that is to look at managed desktop clients. So I'm not that interested in being able to do the whole thing with firewalls and network infrastructure and so on. But I am interested in running a service that other people can use based on LCFG, and they don't need to run LCFG servers. They don't need to understand the whole of LCFG. We can support them. We can provide prepackaged, what Paul called, aspects of the service that will fit the university infrastructure, and it'll work out of the box. So that's a little bit of background where I come from. A little bit of what we're going to talk about today. I've got one slide talking about the history. We've already mentioned that many people spent many years wanting to use LCFG. I'll go into introducing its overall architecture so you get some kind of flavour of what actually goes on underneath the hood sort of thing when you start changing things. And there are two different ways you can implement LCFG, if you like. I'll use the word use there, but Paul already hinted on these in his talk as well. Then we'll have a brief introduction to some of the syntax. Now, the syntax is really quite straightforward. It's not as complicated as something like Perl or any of these other write-only languages. Then we'll have a break. Now, we'll have the break at 10:30, isn't it? Yeah, 10:30. No matter whether I've reached the slide that says we're breaking or I've gone past that slide, we just want to keep to the timetable. If we get ahead, that's great because it gives us slack later in the day. If we go behind, I'll just have to go quicker. And then finally, after coffee and tea and so on, we'll come back and we'll do some of these worked examples in the VMware image so you get some hands-on experience on it. Now, this slide was just stolen from someone else's talk, so you can't hold me to any of this. It might be accurate or not. LCFG has been around a long time, about double the length of time that I've been wanting to use it for. And it says here it's a production tool for 1,000 machines. Now, that'd be way too small now. It must be 1,500 or 2,000 machines or something that are using it in informatics now. Anybody got a number? That order of magnitude, okay. And in the university here, we're going to have at least two or three times that number over the next few couple of years, I would imagine. We're using it already in the open access labs, which have got something like 2,000 machines. We've only got a few hundred at the moment using it for LCFG, dual boot, Linux, Windows. We've got some schools using it for Macs, and so on. So there are going to be more and more machines. We're really scaling up. But as I said, it took me 5 years to get to the point where I can give a talk on LCFG and use it productively. So it's a was a very steep curve, and a lot of effort's going in now to making things simpler and the documentation, the training and all this kind of stuff much better. And there's lots of interesting things going on at the lcfg.org website now. Stephen's done a lot of work to make that website automatically generate lots of data from the live releases and so on. So that's a good place to go to every so often. It's not got anything sexy like discussion boards and things on it, but...
There is a mailing list.
Ah, yes, there's a mailing list that is as active as the participants want it to be, I think, is a good way of putting it. Okay, so here's some of the architecture of LCFG. I'll get my little laser pointer out now. Guide you through this. Now, we've got two screens, so I'll flip between them. You start at this point. I should have had a "you are here" thing. So we start with these sources. These are just icons out of a normal GNOME installation. They represent plain text files. Nothing particularly special there. It's a very Unix-y way of doing things. And we all like that. So some of these sources are all collected together somehow, put through this mangler thing called a compiler on a server, and then served out to all your clients as XML files. Obviously, LCFG has to be buzzword compliant, so that's why it uses XML. And on each of the clients, there's some agent running that takes the XML file and makes the resources available in these XML files to make them available to these things, which we call components, Paul mentioned earlier. So here's the components running down this side. This is where we end up. And it's the component's job to do something on the client to say, ah, okay, I'm supposed to run a web server, so therefore I know how to do that. And I know how to call the host this name, or I know how to edit this file, or so on. Now there's some additional little features in there. Laser. When the compiler, I don't need this, it's not working very well. When the compiler actually generates a new XML profile for a host, it also sends a little packet across the network to that host. It sends it in UDP because it doesn't care if it gets there or not. It's a courtesy, really, and it tells the client, if it's listening, that you should probably go and check right now because I've just published to you a new XML profile. So when you make a change, you might find that it's only maybe 3 or 4 seconds later that it's gone all the way through the system, popped out at the other end in the result that you wanted. So it can be very responsive. Okay, so I think that's... I'm happy to take questions at any time, by the way. So if you feel that there's anything of this you don't understand, pop your hand up. So here we talk about what a component is. Remember, that's the little box down the right-hand side that runs on all your clients. Essentially, it's just a set of resources, which are, think of them as variables. It's just an aspect of what you're trying to configure. And it's the thing that we write. We say, I want this thing to be set to that. And there's other optional features in it. You don't need to have anything more than that in the LCFG framework. Of course, if you want the resource to actually do result in some act on your clients, you have to write some code that will read this resource and perform an action. But LCFG allows you, provides you with a shell or Perl framework to plug in your code. So I've written components where I've thought for a few days about what it is I actually want to do, and then found that it's taken me an afternoon to write maybe 20 lines of shell script, and then I can deploy that component. Of course, version 2 will be much better because it turns out I didn't spend enough days to begin with thinking about it. And one of the nice things about LCFG as well, when you're learning it, and this, again, this is my experience, is all the component code, because it's effectively written in shell script or Perl, and it all lives in one place on the machine, it's under user lib LCFG components, and then the name of the component, you can really quite easily go and have a look at the code and see, wait a minute, yeah, there are only about 5 lines of shell script in here that are doing the thing that I wanted to know. And so there are manual pages for everything, but again, it's really brilliant being able to go back and look at the source to see what it's really doing. And there are methods as well. It's kind of object-orientated sort of thingy, where we say the component gets started at the beginning, like boot up sometime, then it gets stopped at shutdown, but it also has a method called configure that it gets prodded with that method whenever its resources change. A little bit about the compiler. This is the thing that runs on the server. So you've only, in a normal, simplistically you can think of you have one compiler and one server in your environment, but many, many clients. So as I said in the architecture slide, it just takes all these source profiles or source header files or whatever, merges them all together and generates an XML file that's in the well-known format, and hands that over to an Apache web server or whatever web server you want to run to serve them out to the clients. It's got this word classing here to specify groups of clients. So say we've got all the machines in the lab here, we'll have a particular property that we want the same. It could be as simple as a resource that says they all live in this room. Okay? Now, rather than have 50 files all having to set I live in the fifth floor Appleton Tower, they could all just include fifth floor Appleton Tower header file. And when this lab moves to the sixth floor, it's one file you need to change rather than lots of files. So you get the one of the gains of efficiency that Paul was mentioning. You can do these things. It says here it handles some conflicts. Handles is probably too strong a word. It just probably throws an error and says, no, you've got a conflict here. And during the day, we'll see how to debug things or watch the compiler going and so on. And it allows you to have something called a spanning map. A spanning map is essentially, if I understand it correctly, I don't use spanning maps, by the way, because I'm not interested in the relationships between groups of machines and other aspects of other machines. But it allows you to say, I'm a machine, like I'm the firewall, to use Paul's example, and so I want to know all the services that are running and all the other clients. So in that machine's profile, the firewall's profile, XML file, has resources that are values from other machines' XML profiles. So it can do the right thing on behalf of other machines. And there are other examples like who's going to be the SMTP server for all the smart relay for all the other machines in your organization and so on. So again, the beauty of this really is that all the configuration data is available in one place. It's not distributed across hundreds and hundreds of files. You input it in via hundreds and hundreds of files, but you can access it from one central location. You don't need to go and query all the machines. You can predict what's on the machine just by going to the server and saying, can I have a look at this XML profile, please? I want to go and have a look. And you can find out what value that would be on, what, well, would be or is, or you really hope is, on your clients. Has anybody here ever used the Active Directory and group policies for maintaining machines? Yeah, okay. Well, that's almost exactly the opposite. What happens in LCFG is when a configuration changes somehow, the server computes what the result of that change should be and then hands it over to the client. And the client is, in effect, done. The component there sees, I've got a resource that changes, I'll act upon it. It doesn't say, I've got this resource, but again, this other component over here has got this other resource, and that actually this resource has been set further up as well. Oh my goodness, what am I going to do? That's how Active Directory works. Active Directory works, the domain controllers maintain a copy of all the, if you like, the sources, and there is, in effect, a compiler running on each of your Windows clients, which munges them all together, and then hands that over to the code on the local clients. So that means in order to find out what the machine has ended up with, you have to ask the machine. There's nothing else to ask. In Windows 2003, they've enhanced that with group policy modeling where they can run this process on the domain controllers as well. So remember again that whenever things change, the changes are at least made available to the clients essentially immediately. We don't need to go through a reboot phase like we do in other OSs and many other configuration systems. And again, we've got the scalability by saying we can take common settings, stick them in a file, and include them from hundreds or thousands of all your other hosts. Yep. Right, okay. The question was, I'm doing this for the recording purposes, is there an ability to query the individual machines for what their actual settings are, rather than assuming that whatever you changed has fed all the way through the system, which is, of course, an asynchronous operation? The answer is yes. Well, the answer is that it depends, which is always the answer in LCFG or Unix, to be honest. Depends how you set it up. But there is a facility whereby there's a logging server running on all your clients, and that just a simple HTTP. And so, and also the server, the compiler, the machine the compiler's running on, your server, it maintains web pages with links to all your clients that it knows about. And you can just press a button there and it'll go and ask the client what it is. But that does rely upon the clients being online at the time. Okay. So the other half of the magic really comes from the client component. The compiler runs on the server. The client component runs, obviously, on the clients. So its primary job is to sit there and wait for notifications from the server. That's pretty much all it does. Whenever it gets a notification, or you can set it up and tell it to poll every 10 minutes or every hour or every 24 hours, whatever, it compares the XML profile that is just received with the previous one. And it looks through, and because it's XML, it's possible to see which individual resources have changed in that. Whenever some resources have changed, it then tells the component that owns these resources it's changed by calling its configure method. Again, I said it was object-orientated. Well, that's what it does. The client, obviously, also at startup time goes and gets a new profile as well to make sure. Yes? Okay.
If someone manually changes
the
file,
yeah.
The file gets corrupted.
Okay. The question was, does the client component also look at the actual configuration of the machine to decide that there's a change come in? The answer is no, it doesn't. All it has at its disposal is the old profile, the previous profile, and the current one. And it does its comparisons on that. Now, individual components might be written so as to say, I'll go and check to see if there's been a change here. But really, what the philosophy is that the data in the XML profile is what should end up the result of your machine. So if somebody's gone and edited something, then most likely at next startup time, because normally most components, when they start up at boot time, they also do a configure method. So they will simply overwrite whatever somebody's done. So we do have circumstances where people, for example, install an extra package on a machine, and then at the next reboot cycle, it just uninstalls that package because it knows the list of packages this machine should have. So that's an example.
Sorry.
Yes?
And you again comes out the list of dependency changes. Does that mean that you'll have to change the list of installed packages should be installed in the server? And you'll pick those depending on the update?
Yes, the question was when a new RPM comes out or is updated and the dependencies have changed on that, then do we need to actually tell the server somehow that this dependencies have changed so that the dependencies can be satisfied on the clients? The answer is yes, there is. Alistair is going to talk more about that in the afternoon. Possibly. Right. I coined a phrase here, heavyweight LCFG. As Paul mentioned earlier, LCFG is normally represented in this method simply because that's the way it's been used in almost the only places it's been used is it manages absolutely everything on all your clients. There's nothing else getting in there doing stuff, and there really shouldn't be any sysadmins doing anything locally on the clients either. To do this, the clients run something like 50 different components. So there's a lot of code there running for managing different aspects of the machine. And really, I've added a note here. It's a bit like managing your own distribution of Linux, because you need to set up absolutely everything in configuration first, including complete lists of packages to be installed and all the dependencies and so on. The benefits are what Paul said earlier. You've got things like reliability, you've got no manual changes, but you don't really need to do this. Why don't you need to do it? Well, it is incredibly committing. As I said, it's like running your own distribution from scratch almost. And it's very difficult to learn. Yes?
It is worth saying that we have supported platforms which we do know support.
Oh, right. Okay. Yes. It's not like running a distribution from scratch. The supported platforms are effectively taken, the upstream distribution and then LCFG added on top. Yes, you're right, sorry. I logged on to a typical machine like one of these here, and I queried the XML profile to find out how many resources were set in it. These are all heavyweight managed clients that you're sitting at the moment. And there were around about 2,500 resources set on these clients. Now, for anybody to carry that amount of configuration around in their head, that's a big job. So that's why it's very, very committing. Plus, if you're starting out from fresh and new and you haven't been exposed to this before and you don't realize that you don't actually need to know about any of these, hardly, at the beginning, you very quickly run into you can't see the wood for the trees or the trees for the wood. Because you could think, oh, I'll just change this resource without realizing that actually changing that resource will mean you can't log into your machine. So all these kind of things do happen. And I know because I've done them. So there's another way of using LCFG is this concept of lightweight use. So Paul mentioned earlier again that you can choose to run only one or two components on your clients. The important one is to run the client component, of course, because otherwise there'll be no communication with your server. You can continue to run whatever management system you've got, whether that be going around with a floppy disk or running CF Engine or whatever, or your own homegrown scripts. As long as you're not trying to manage the same aspect of the machine with two different systems, that's fine. We all know that. And as you gain more comfort with LCFG, more experience, more knowledge, understand it a bit better, and also have maybe new requirements that you think, actually, I'm more comfortable extending LCFG than extending my homegrown scripts or trying to use some other configuration system you use, you can just add to it over time. And one of the benefits of the architecture of LCFG is this is all completely possible without you're not stretching LCFG. You're not trying to change the underlying architecture of the system in order to do this. It's quite happy only managing particular aspects, and that's a fully supported way of doing things. And also, of course, for learning this is really useful because you can concentrate on the kind of half dozen resources that you've got set for this one component. And when you're learning the whole system and the architecture, don't choose a component that will disable your machine if you get it wrong. Choose a component that's completely safe, that's like a sandbox to play in then. You're going to love this next slide. I stole this slide from someone else, and the only change I made to it was I put the quotes around reduced, because initially you think, yeah, that's quite easy. But when you look into it, the number, as I said earlier, you get 2,500 resources set. Well, that's actually quite a large problem to come up with. And we can't expect people just to go away and put something out of the box, have it all running, and then immediately understand the consequences of all these 2,500 resources set. So it is a big problem still, although it's reduced because there's a tool now to assist you doing it. Now the bit why you all came here. A bit of LCFG syntax. Right, I'm going to rattle through this because it's not particularly difficult. I'm going to talk about how you set these resources. And an aspect of setting is also mutating, so changing them. Including other files to give you that ability to class things together. And I'll mention the fact that it uses the C preprocessor. So when you want to set a resource, the syntax is incredibly simple. You give the component name, which owns the resource, a period, and then the resource name. Then everything after that is set as the value for that resource. So for example, here we're telling the client component that you go and pull the XML profile from the server every 10 minutes. And if you look at the manual page for this component, the client component, you'll see that this plus 30s means, and put a randomization of 30 seconds in as well. So if all your machines booted up at exactly 9 o'clock in the morning, they're not all going to happen, going to do it at 10 past 9. They'll randomize. The compiler doesn't allow you to set the same resource twice. It throws an error if you try to do that. And that's it attempting to handle conflicts. Because if you've got two files trying to just simply set something, then there's a conflict. So what you want to do is you want to have a way of adding or changing somehow or removing bits of values of resources. And in the notes that you've got, I give a reference into the guide, the big PDF guide. Did they get that printed out, by the way? Everybody's got a copy of that. So hopefully on page 42 you'll see a list of all these macros, and these are C preprocessor macros. So you have to tell the compiler that, that you're doing a mutation rather than a setting by putting an exclamation mark at the front. And there's an example. And that's simply telling the server component to take its current value of its source path resource and add slash temp onto it, which isn't a very good idea to do in the real world, but that just simply tells it you can look for these source profiles for all the clients it knows about in the temp directory as well. Okay, the question was, does every mutation have to have the pling at the front, the exclamation mark at the front, or can you simply... Well, the answer is yes. In fact, the compiler's quite happy for you to mutate an empty value. So when I'm writing header files, quite often I end up just saying, well, I'm going to set this value here, but actually what I'll do is I'll mutate it. And one of the mutation macros is simply set the value. You have to. It depends on how the component's written and also documented as to how it handles a list of things. Is it that it looks, for example, if it's a search path, the order can be important. But if it's simply a list of packages, then the order obviously isn't important. So, you need to bear that in mind when you're writing your source files. Yeah. Each component has a schema file which defines what it's expecting in each resource. And you can use the C preprocessor to simply include things. So there's an example. All your Linux clients need some tweaks, and you want to include a special file that just has tweaks for Linux clients in it. And the last slide there, you've got the complete guide minus the manual pages. It's online, including the manual pages. On any LCFG machine with installed components on it, you can say man LCFG hyphen then the component name, and it will tell you all the schema for the resources and so on, and the methods it uses, and hopefully how it does things. If you don't have the component installed, you can still follow various links on the website. You can go to the releases, and then it will tell you the list of packages for the release, and then there's a little info button on each one. Again, this says in the notes here. and it will take you to the fully generated documentation, including the manual pages. So you can find out about components you haven't installed as well. And that's it. We'll break for tea and coffee.